Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in snowy Boston, and this is The World in Words number 39. Today, an all-singing, all-dancing Persian podcast. The BBC launches a Persian language TV channel, also Persian radio, out of Israel. Then, two Iranian-American writers, a terrorism spy novelist and the author of Funny in Farsi. Plus, of course, untranslatable Persian.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here. They all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is, merci beaucoup.
Yerkshamash. Today, we are all Borat. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. You can also hear The Big Show online at theworld.org. That's also where you can hear all of our other podcasts, including our very latest. Take it away, guys.
Alex, what's this contraption?
Oh, yes, I'm just spooling through some tape to find some items for this week's Best Of podcast.
You do know that we cut all of our tape on the computer now.
You strange wizard.
The World's Best Of podcast. Find out more at theworld.org.
Okay, so today we're going to dance around Iran a little bit. I say around because all of the stories and the interviews that I'm offering today originate from outside Iran. It's a sad fact of life that reporting from within Iran, getting reporters' visas, it's all tightly restricted. We do occasionally have access to reports and reporters within Iran, but not very often. Next time that we do, I'm going to try and get a story commissioned on how nearly 30 years of religious rule has affected the development of the Persian language. I think that would be a really interesting topic. That said, we have a really entertaining podcast for you this week, starting with Persian language TV from the BBC, Persian language radio out of Israel. Then we're going to spend some time in the company of a couple of Iranian-American writers. Sharp and funny storytellers, they are too. And then finally, we'll be sitting down to eat sideways with Azar Nafisi, author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. So first, you say Farsi, I say Persian. You say information, I say propaganda. No, this is not my attempt to sound idiotic yet self-satisfied, like Alan Partridge. Well, maybe it is. This is my attempt to introduce the next two segments, both of them being about efforts to bring information to Iran from the outside. Not surprising when you consider that there's very little in the way of independent broadcast media inside Iran. Now, there's an addition to what Iranians can see on TV, at least people with satellite dishes. The BBC has just launched a new Persian language television service operating out of London. Reporter Sarus Farivar did the story for The Big Show on the day the channel debuted.
Here's what viewers of the new BBC Persian television channel heard today.
Salam be televizyon farsi khosh umedid. Televizyon tazeyi az majmuye BBC.
That's one of BBC Persian's new announcers welcoming viewers in Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. The BBC brand is already well known and respected in Iran. Its Persian language radio service has been broadcast there for the past 60 years. But fewer people are getting their news from the radio these days, says Nigel Chapman, the head of the BBC World Service.
Television is the preferred medium of choice for news and information in Iran. That's what Iranians use. So if you're not going to be on television in this market, you do really run the risk, as the BBC, of becoming less relevant, less accessible, audiences declining, and just reducing your impact, and that's not something we want to see.
The BBC has budgeted $25 million a year for 8 hours a day of Persian language programming. It's available only by satellite. Officially, satellite TV is illegal in Iran. But many Iranians have access to satellite dishes, and they're already watching other foreign Persian language stations, like the U.S.-sponsored Voice of America. But many Iranians don't trust it because even though it's supposed to be independent, it's seen as rarely critical of the U.S. government.
I hope BBC Persian, television to be broadcast, independently and not like Voice of American, like propaganda of the U.S. government.
That's Ruzbeh Mirebrahimi, an Iranian journalist now living in New York. He says that while his family back home will be able to see BBC Persian on TV, he'll be watching it online. Besides VOA and now the BBC, the other non-government Persian language channels are mostly broadcast by Iranian exiles living in Los Angeles. While many in Iran tune into these stations for their music and cultural programming, their news and political coverage isn't taken seriously, says Hadi Ghaemi. He's with the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran.
They have been extremely unprofessional and have become a joke in Iran to such an extent that the government actually tapes them and makes a collage of them and shows them as humor on Friday evenings, on weekend nights, inside Iran.
Ghaemi says the BBC is a welcome addition to the Persian language media landscape. That being said, many Iranians may not be aware of the BBC's small role in their country's history. According to a BBC documentary, in 1953, during a BBC English language broadcast, a single code word was spoken. That word alerted Mohammad Reza Shah of Iran that the coup ending Iran's only democratically elected government was underway. It was this coup, backed by the United States and Britain, that ushered the Shah into power. Given that history, it's likely that Iran's current leaders will be keeping close tabs on the new BBC Persian service. For The World, I'm Sarus Farivar.
If Iranian authorities are suspicious of the BBC, just imagine how they feel about Persian language broadcasting sponsored by the Israeli government. Now, of course, Iran and Israel famously don't get on. Iran supports Hezbollah and Hamas. Its president has said that Israel should be wiped off the map. And then, earlier this year, according to press reports, Israel asked Washington for a green light to bomb Iranian nuclear sites. So, with all of that bad blood, you can imagine how the Iranian government reacts to the Voice of Israel radio news in Persian. From Jerusalem, here's reporter Matt Gutman.
Hundreds of thousands of Iranians tune in to the Voice of Israel's Persian language broadcasts every Sunday evening. That's more than the number of Israelis who tune in to their own public broadcasts in Hebrew. It's not bad for a station whose budget is very tight. Voice of Israel employees are known to forage for fax paper in Israeli government ministries. Their dusty radio equipment is more than 30 years old. Menashe Amir is the director of the Voice of Israel's Persian language service. He's also its star host. Amir says the secret to the success of the programming is that it offers something in short supply in Iran, straight news.
Our broadcast tries to be so objective and to give thoroughly report about the situation inside Iran, and especially internal affairs like the price of fuel, the price of cheese, that every Iranian needs to know about.
Iranian listeners and callers tune into a daily news show, a weekly call-in show, and a few news magazines. The broadcasts are especially popular among the Iranian intelligentsia. Menashe Amir has been broadcasting to Iran for 47 years. He's been blasting the country's Islamic regime since it took power in 1979, and Amir and his colleagues are not letting up on Iranian leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Next, we are going to discuss with the Iranian listeners inside Iran around the question whether Ahmadinejad's cabinet is a good one and if the Iranian president has a psychological balance.
Such topics embolden Iranian listeners. This caller says Iranians are waiting for a miracle that will help them overthrow the regime. Amir's tough line against Iran's leaders has won him admirers in Iran. It's also won him enemies. Iranian government news agencies have tried to debunk Amir's broadcasts. He takes pride in that. The Iranians have also accused the Voice of Israel of espionage. Amir denies it.
I can swear that we neither have a reporter inside Iran nor a spy. But please give me the opportunity not to explain to you how and where from we get our news about Iran.
Many Iranian listeners learned to trust the Voice of Israel during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. Israeli analyst Meir Jabadanfar grew up in Tehran. He says Amir was considered more credible than the Iranian newscasters.
his objectivity was definitely a plus, because Iranian people wanted objectivity. They didn't want lies. The Iranian government during the war told many lies in the news. And Iranian people, you know, used to start by listening to Iranian news and then used to go and listen to the Voice of Israel and kind of measure the difference.
But that was then. Jabhat Anfar says young Iranians are now less likely to tune in to Amir's show than their parents were.
Young generation of Iranians are more interested in economic news or music or, you know, youth issues. They are not too interested in politics as much as their predecessors were. The priority of the Iranian people now is the economy more than politics or just relaxing.
But Amir is not softening his shows or his views on what's needed to resolve the many problems Iran poses to its people and the international community.
If you ask my private opinion, the only solution is to overthrow the fundamentalist, extremist, radical regime inside Iran.
Amir says that's a job for the Iranian people. He's just there to report the news. For The World, I'm Matt Gutman in Jerusalem.
Straight news, objective news. Whenever people make claims like that, I get suspicious. Can't help it. Still to come in this Persian podfest, we have the authors of Funny in Farsi and Reading Lolita in Tehran. First, a profile that I did for the big show of a US-based Iranian writer. His name is Salah Abdo. Abdo wrote an extraordinary spy novel about Islamic terrorists planning an attack in New York. And in case you're wondering, he wrote this before September 11th, 2001. And that book is just the start of his story. Here's my report. Salah Abdo grew up reading the literary spy thrillers of Graham Greene and John le Carré. Abdo knew he wanted to write similar books, but with a radically different cast of characters, culled from Iran and beyond. Not so long ago, Abdo published his first novel, The Poet Game, a story that follows an Iranian intelligence agent as he's dispatched to New York to break up an Islamic terrorist plot against the U.S.
When you look at the back of it, the first three lines of the blurb, it says, after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, New York City is ground zero for a band of Muslim terrorists, blah, blah, blah. So when people see that, and then when they read the book and they come to my reading and listen to whatever chapter I'm reading, sometimes people can't help but ask, I guess, what's the inevitable question? How do you know these things?
Abdo's answer is first to deny the often implied accusation that he himself is a spy. He knows, he says, that Muslim groups had been planning attacks on the U.S. simply by reading and observing in the right places. Of course, it takes a certain type of mind, obsessed by intrigue, to do that, and Abdo fits the bill. He was born in 1965 into a well-to-do Iranian family. He was sent to boarding school in England, where he suffered racist taunts and developed a taste for mind games. In 1980, his father, under threat of death, fled revolutionary Iran for the US, taking his three sons with him. Within months, his father had died from a heart attack, and the 15-year-old Abdo was living on the streets of Los Angeles, selling pills and faking an English accent. He eventually enrolled at the University of California, Berkeley, where he developed an interest in Middle Eastern history. Soon after, he visited his homeland and learned the value of going undercover.
I had just left Berkeley, the capital of liberalism in the U.S. I just left it and gone to Iran. And at the time, I had very long beard, longer than any of these fundamentalists. And for a number of reasons, within a week, I found myself sitting in this office where one of the people who ran the office was the brother of the guy who was in charge of the Revolutionary Guards, or this paramilitary organization that's ultra-conservative and supports the supreme leader and all that. And I was just sitting there as an actor almost, watching these guys play with their prayer beads. So I picked up a prayer bead and did the same thing. I guess what saved the day for me was my beard was longer than anybody else's in that room that day.
Abdo picked up a lot about the Iranian secret service on that visit, in part because Iran's government was so easy to penetrate, much more so than in, say, Iraq or Syria, dictatorships ruled by fear. In Iran, a partially open society, dozens of factions jockey for power and are willing to spill the beans on their competitors. which makes Abdo all the more exasperated that, in his view, the CIA is doing such a poor job of keeping tabs on Iran. It all comes down, he says, to recruitment.
Let me just give you the experience of somebody I'll call X.
Don't be surprised if this potential recruit sounds suspiciously like Salah Abdo.
X was from the Middle East, from a certain Middle Eastern country. He was called to one of the American intelligence agencies, I won't say which one. He had a degree in Near Eastern studies. He could speak Persian. He knew Arabic. He went there. He took the test with 50 other people. He finished in about 5 minutes, the language test. The rest of the people probably took about 3 hours. The people who talked to him said to him that he was a perfect candidate. Nevertheless, he didn't get the job.
X didn't get the job, says Abdo, because his past was too checkered and because U.S. spy agencies are paranoid about being penetrated by double agents. The result, Abdo says, is that agencies are peopled by bland bureaucrats who have lived little and traveled less. Abdo doesn't need to travel far from his current home to come across potential models for his novels, as he shows me. He lives on 44th Street in Manhattan, a half a block from Times Square. Just a few feet from his apartment building, there's a doorway leading to what Abdo says used to be a hole-in-the-wall mosque.
On a Friday afternoon at 1 p.m. when they had the Muslim Friday prayer, this place would get packed. And you would see all these shoes of men lying here because they can't go in there with shoes. And then the crowd would spill right into the sidewalk. And there would be people praying in rows all along here. And then the tourists would be passing here going to Sodom and Gomorrah down the street, which is Times Square to these guys. And they would just stand around and watch these men praying, you know, and they would not know what's going on. There would be a smile on people's face. And the men, they absolutely would pay no attention and they just would continue to pray. And being in the neighborhood, I used to come here sometimes and just pray alongside them, not out of belief, but just to see what they talk about, what they have to say. And it was an interesting place, and it was here for until about 2 years ago, and then it just got too small and they moved it somewhere else.
Given Abdo's strange ability to be in certain key places at certain crucial times, it seems natural that on September 11th, 2001, at 8:45 a.m., he was teaching a composition class a block and a half from the World Trade Center. He and his students, 18 and 19-year-olds from Manhattan Community College, evacuated the building after the first plane hit the North Tower.
We were watching the smoke come out of the first building when the second blast hit. Before that, we'd been watching people fall or actually jump to their deaths from those upper floors of the first building. And my students, some of them really started losing it. And I was trying to prevent them from watching anymore because they were screaming and weeping. And I had one of them in my chest, you know, just sort of. And as I did that, as I turned it around towards me, the second blast came. And we sort of all lost contact with one another. In retrospect, what I should have done was to just walk away from the side after the first blast and make them come with me. But I was just so mesmerized in a way by what was going on. I couldn't move, and they felt like if they were around me, they would be safe. Just this psychological thing. And of course, there was no safety anywhere that day.
In the wake of the attack, bookstores reported a run on the Poet Game, which had just come out in paperback. And Abdo changed the plot of his upcoming novel so it wouldn't be seen to be exploiting the tragedy, still so raw in people's memories. In fact, there's only one reference to September 11th in Salah Abdo's new novel called With Opium. One character looking at Manhattan's skyline calls it beautiful. The response comes, it used to look better. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. Salah Abdo has also recently been writing a historical piece. He emailed me about this last week. Here's what he said. I left the modern world behind for the past. Okay, now to Firuzeh Dumar. She was a little younger than Salah Abdo when she moved to the U.S. from Iran. She was just 7. And where did she move? Southern California, the world of fast food, suntans, and Mickey Mouse. Dumar describes this and much more in her books Funny in Farsi, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America, and Laughing Without an Accent. Here she is in conversation with The Big Show's Lisa Mullins.
Okay, Firuze, what's your most vivid memory when you first moved to the United States?
The first time I went into an American supermarket, I walked down the cereal aisle, and I just froze. In Abadan, we used to have cornflakes with the rooster on the cover, and all of a sudden, I was in an aisle full of boxes and boxes with colorful pictures on them. I thought I was in a toy store, because in Iran, we used to have lavash, which is a flatbread, and feta cheese and tea. And I just thought these American kids were so lucky, because they got to have candy in the morning.
You mean cereal?
Cereal, but to me, I thought it was candy.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of food, I want to talk a little bit about your father, because it's kind of interesting. When your father first came here, it was without the family. He was an engineer, an oil engineer on a Fulbright scholarship. So the rest of the family looked on him as kind of, you know, the veteran, very proud to bring the remainder of the family to America. And when you all arrived, you realized he didn't know as much as you thought he knew. And that was especially apparent when you went into restaurants.
Right. We'd say, what exactly are hush puppies or a sloppy Joe? And he'd ask the waitress, and then the waitress would say something. And my dad would say, she doesn't know.
This is after she went on with an explanation that lasted 45
Absolutely.
Seconds. Your dad was a big fan of Disneyland, wasn't he?
My dad loves Disneyland. He loved Disneyland more than Walt Disney himself. And we used to go there every chance that we got, which is about every other weekend. And we went there so often that I didn't want to go there anymore.
Yeah, but also you say it wasn't even just the rides that he loved.
No. What he was really impressed with was how clean Disneyland was. You know, whenever you go to Disneyland, they have these 16, 17-year-olds walking around with little tiny brooms and just sweeping up any trash that's on the ground. And my father would always go up to them and say, you're doing a very good job. It is very, very clean here. And I remember they would just look at my father like, who is this man? And the other thing that really impressed him about Disneyland was how people would just wait patiently in lines. And he'd say, man, this was any other country. People would be pushing and shoving, but not here. This is America. This is Disneyland.
You know, I actually hear that from a lot of immigrants from other countries. They say people actually obey the stoplights.
Right. There's a near where my parents live, there's a four-way stoplight. And when they first moved there, my dad would say, you know, even when there's nobody else around, people still stop. It's amazing. Of course, he, have to admit, got a few tickets for not stopping, but now he does.
You know, I want to talk more about your family because I know how family-centered Iranians are. In fact, they have words for different kinds of relatives, someone who's related, for instance, to your mother versus your father's side. And who is Uncle Nematollah?
Amu Nematollah is my father's brother. He is a character. Well, my uncle came to visit us in Whittier the first year that we were here. He and my father just went on this eating escapade for months. We would just go to the supermarket every time my dad would come home from work, buy everything that we saw that we thought looked interesting, try it, and then we'd do the same thing the next day. Now, in between all these escapades to the supermarket, we used to also visit all the fast food restaurants, which we never had in Abadan. And one day, my uncle went into his suitcase of clothes and realized that none of his clothes fit him. And he'd only been in America for a couple months. And this, of course, set him off in a panic. And he said, you know, well, I have to do something. And in between eating, we used to watch television nonstop. And so we had seen a lot of ads for these weight loss gimmicks. So he just started ordering them. And then at one point, he finally found something that clicked with him. It was something called the Body Shaper. And it was a nylon pulley cord system. And you attached it to a doorknob. And you would lie on the floor and do these contortions. And just, you know, become human scissors and slice through the air for hours. And for whatever reason, this just stuck with him. And he did lose the weight. But, you know, we learned the hard way never to open a closed door without first listening for the swoosh, swoosh, swoosh coming from behind it.
You know, it's funny because it seems like your family so much embraced American culture, but I think it was difficult. I mean, in fact, I know from your book that it was very difficult. And one of the things that you point to is a sense of cultural superiority that Iranians have. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, where did they sort of draw the line and say, you know, that's just too American or that's not right for us?
Well, you know, when we first came here, it was before the revolution, and it was a different America than it is today. When we found that Americans had actually never heard of Iran, and this was back in 1972. So we found that rather puzzling because, of course, we know that Iran is a small country, but we were surprised that we were basically invisible. After the revolution, things changed so much here. I mean, America and Americans changed, and it just became a far less friendly place. And we found that Americans really weren't interested in Iran anymore because, having watched the 5 o'clock news, they felt that they now knew Iran and they understood Iranians. And oftentimes what you see on television, you know, the 2 minutes of international coverage that we get in this country, it's always the worst of the worst. And it does not represent in any way the majority of the Iranian population. And I remember seeing bumper stickers that said, "Iranians go home," or "We play cowboys and Iranians." And it was just sort of open season on Iranians. It seemed like it was fair to hate all of us.
You were still pretty young in 1979 when the Islamic Revolution happened. And I wonder if even at the time when you were watching TV, if you realized how terrifying for Americans it was to turn on the TV and see the rage of these Iranians, the hostage takers who were leading a group of blindfolded Americans.
Oh, absolutely. We were terrified, too. I mean, this was also our country, and we felt like we could not relate at all to what we were seeing on television, because the majority of Iranians had always been very fond of America. And to this day, a majority of Iranians want to have relations with this country. So the people that we were seeing on television, believe it or not, were as foreign to us as they were to you.
Do you, I mean, in these days where President Bush has called Iran part of the axis of evil, do you feel a sense of deja vu? I mean, do you feel as though it's the same kind of reaction that you're getting, or is it different now?
Well, when I heard that President Bush called Iran axis of evil, I was horrified because I thought, well, I remember when Khomeini called America the great Satan, I was horrified. And I thought, well, why is this country now calling Iran axis of evil? And the thing that really upset me was that there's a difference between the Iranian government and the Iranian people. And by labeling a country something like axis of evil, what you're doing inadvertently, perhaps, is labeling the entire country. And that certainly is not improvement.
Is your book being published in Farsi?
Well, humor is very culture specific. And I always use the example, when we first came, we used to watch, of course, a lot of television. And whenever anybody would throw a pie in someone's face, we thought that was so rude. We didn't think that was funny at all. And we could never understand why there was a laugh track that went on.
Maybe we can say that one common denominator with both cultures is the late, great Bob Hope.
Oh, our Christmases consisted of watching the Bob Hope Christmas special.
Do you have the book right in front of you now, Feruze?
Yes, I do.
I wonder if you can just pick up a little bit of that paragraph at the bottom of page 107.
Okay. This is from a chapter in my book called Me and Bob Hope. My parents had a particular fondness for the annual Bob Hope Christmas specials with frequent guest star Brooke Shields. They didn't understand any of Bob's jokes, but my father laughed along with the laugh tracks. Then my father would ask, "What did he say?" And that was how I spent Christmas Eve, translating Bob Hope's jokes into Persian. Of course, for my father, Bob Hope was more than just a comedian. He was a dignified older man who wore sharp suits, had great posture, and managed to be witty without ever getting nervous. I think that secretly, my father wanted to be Bob Hope.
Feruzeh Dumas, she is the author most recently of Laughing Without an Accent. And now it's time for Eating Sideways, what has become a weekly segment on a tough-to-translate foreign term. This week, Eating Sideways is coming to you in, well, of course it has to be, Persian. So we get a little help this week from the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, Azar Nafisi. The Big Show's Marco Werman asked her for an example of a Persian phrase that isn't easily rendered into English. And here is what she came up with.
Well, I'm going to read two lines from our great poet Hafiz, and one line specially is untranslatable. از خلاف آمد عادت به طلب کام که من کسب جمعیت از آن زلف پریشان کردم. The basic meaning of this poem is that you should always go against habit. This is the first line. The second line is difficult because it's so metaphorical. He says that I came together through looking or through dealing with those dispersed tresses of hair of his beloved. Hair in Persian, hair of the beloved in Persian poetry is very important. And the tresses separate rather than, you know, so it's very difficult. The coming togetherness and the dispersion at the same time.
Is it the metaphor of hair that's kind of like hard to actually translate?
Because there is one word there, kasb-e jam'iyyat, and that jam'iyyat is both togetherness, but in Persian it also talks about a spiritual state of peace and calm, you know, when everything comes together. Well, with hair in English, you can't do that, you know, and then hair also has strands that are separate.
And is the hair metaphor the idea of tresses is kind of one, but also dispersed. Yes, one, is that common throughout
Mystical poetry. Persian mystical poetry partly lives on this irony of having two opposites in a single entity. And I like what people think about Iran. It's so erotic in its poetry. So the figure of the beloved and the hair itself becomes a metaphor for so many thoughts.
Azar Nafisi. Her new memoir is called Things I've Been Silent About. And the name again of the great 14th century Persian poet she mentioned is Hafez. That's Hafez/Z. That's it for this time. Please message me on Facebook or post something at the Facebook group, The World in Words, or write to me at this email, language@pri.org. Talk to you next week.